Welcome to the Winter Palace. I'm your host, Mark Cole, editor and publisher of Odessa Steps Magazine. We're happy to welcome back to the show the king of Kingsport, Bo James, although I wish it was under better circumstances, as we're going to mainly talk about a couple of recent wrestling deaths. The first is Ole Anderson, the legendary wrestler, booker, probably best known now as a member of the original Four Horsemen. We're going to talk about his long career, including when Bo first saw him growing up in East Tennessee, his longtime partnership with Gene Anderson, his booking in Georgia and Mid-Atlantic, and Bo's going to tell us some stories about when he used to run into Ole at the Gulf Coast Wrestler Reunion shows in the 90s. We're also going to talk about the death of Mike Jones, better known as Virgil during his WF time. Bo's going to tell us a great story about one of the times that he ran into working with him on a fair show in the 1990s. That's going to segue into a discussion about the Iron Claw movie. Bo hasn't gotten a chance to see it, but he knows all about it. So we're going to talk about some of the things they did in the movie that were really cool, some of the historical inaccuracies, and balancing that versus dramatic license in a film. And that's going to segue into a long discussion about being a wrestling historian, having to do research on a business that's based on a lie. Can you trust people's memories? Can you trust them even if their memory is good? So we're going to talk about a lot of those kind of things. And then, so shout out to some of our fellow wrestling historians out there, like Al Getz and Mike Sempervivi and Greg Klein, amongst others. Bo is also going to tell us a bunch of funny stories, as Bo always does, including a bunch of stories about Ron and Don Wright, with them working with people such as Luthez and Danny Hodge back in the day. This is a great show. It's always good to have Bo tell stories. Bo's also going to talk about his promotion, Southern States Wrestling, and their recent Hall of Fame and some of the events that they have coming up in the future. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. Back to the Winter Palace. It's been a while, continuing the trend of having people back on the show after a while. We're happy to welcome back Bo James, the King of Kingsport, to the show. We are trying to fish around for things to talk about, and now we've had, unfortunately, we had a bunch of wrestlers pass away recently, including someone that is probably very near and dear to Bo's heart, not him personally, but certainly from the era he grew up in, and that was the passing of Ole Anderson. So we're going to talk about that. Maybe we'll talk about some of the other people who have passed away, and then maybe whatever else is going on in the world of wrestling and other things like that. So how are you doing, Bo?
Doing well. Fighting a little sinus trouble, as we was talking about off the air. The weather from here to you is just killing all of us.
Yeah, I was saying, I think it's rained almost every day this week. It's funny, it's rained, but it's getting warmer. So it's funny. I remember I was talking to somebody at work the first, like last week about how warm it was. And I was like, March does not come in like a lamb. March is supposed to come in like a lion and leave like a lamb. And if we're already coming in as a lamb, what's it going to be like at the end? So it's like, yeah, we'll probably have snow at the end of March or something weird like that.
We have had snow here. I can remember, I think it was 1987 or 88, we got a big snow on April the 1st. So, and it was kind of remind you of the year we're having now when that happened. So I'm not giving up on another big snow for the year here in East Tennessee.
Well, I remember they said beginning of the year that this was going to be like a bad winter weather season. And we've had snow a couple of times that, you know, cause like delays at work and things like that. But I know we had one a couple of weeks ago where it snowed overnight, which is probably not a big deal for most people, except the fact that I work overnight. So we watched as the snow came, the snow started like after midnight. And so by the time we left, you know, we had a couple inches of snow on the ground, and it was just, but it was the weekend, so they didn't bother like delaying work or anything like that, but we still had to trudge home. And then it was warm that afternoon, and most of it was gone by the time we came back in that night. But
yeah,
it's like
we had one of those like that here too.
But yeah, so like I said, we had been talked a couple weeks ago about it had been a while since you had been on. We were trying to figure out what to talk about, and one of the things we'll get to eventually. But in the meantime, Ole Anderson passed away at the age of 81. And certainly where you grew up, you know, in Tennessee, where you certainly got a lot of Jim Crockett. So you definitely saw a lot of Ole growing up, both in Crockett and Georgia, right?
Yeah. My first memory, and I don't even, I was very little. My first memory of Ole Anderson was, and I believe it was Paul Jones, when Gene stuck his head over the top, stepped on the bottom rope and stuck his head in, and he ran the opponent's head into Gene, and Gene took the bump to the floor, and he sacrificed his brother to get the win. That's like my first memory of Ole Anderson. And he was always, you know, the big heel on the Mid-Atlantic TV that I could remember. But he had a short babyface run in Knoxville in 1980.
It's funny. I was looking at his title history and, you know, looking for, you know, all the various times he was a tag team champion with Gene and a couple times with Stan Hansen. And then I saw Southeastern heavyweight title, and I was like, huh? But then I figured, well, maybe he was champion like during the Mulligan Flair era, but I guess it was actually in the Barnett era.
In the Barnett, yeah. Yeah, he had a, he worked a program with Killer Carl Cox. And that was also, during that was the first time that I can remember seeing a heel referee. And I forget the referee's name. I'd have to go watch it. But he was Cox's buddy from the Marine Corps, and they had double-crossed Ole, and Ole was chasing him, and then Ole beat Cox for the title, and then Ole lost the title to Sugar Bear Harris, who would later become Kamala, and Ole went back to Atlanta, and I think that's when they did the big turn on Dusty in the cage.
Well, I was about ready to say that if he was a face there in 1980, that he would have been a face leading up to the big turn in Georgia. So I guess that,
yeah,
that sort of makes sense.
Yeah, it was, Ole was one of those guys that, he was believable because he was real. If you met Ole Anderson on the street, you met Ole Anderson. You met the exact same guy that you met on TV, that you saw on TV. He was gruff and he was rough and he just cussed everybody and just, and I got to know Ole through the Gulf Coast Wrestlers reunion, you know, late in his life, and the health problems were just starting with him. And, you know, I saw him when he had to go into the wheelchair and that stuff. And it was sad to see, knowing what he once was, and then seeing him as he was there. And the last year that we were at the Gulf Coast reunion, Ole was in the room next to us at the hotel. So he would sit on the sidewalk in the mornings just waiting to cuss somebody, you know, I mean, just waiting to be Ole to somebody. And Misty, had forgot something in the car, and she looks out and she's like, "Would you please go get it? Ole's sitting out there. I don't want to hear him today." You know, she's like, I don't want to, you know, just please go get it. And so I go outside to get it out of the car, and he looks up and he sees me and he goes, "Well, how the F are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I was doing all right till I come out here and saw your miserable ass. Now you've just messed my whole day up. It's just ruined." And he popped. He started laughing. He wanted somebody to give it back to him.
That's what it sounds like when you hear people tell stories, that it's sort of like he maybe starts to like people as soon as they feel comfortable enough to give some of it back.
Well, and that was, I would give it back to him, or I'd say stuff to him, or he'd do his thing of, "Oh, do you not know anything? Are you stupid?" You know, and I say, "Well, I must be, because I'm sitting here talking to you when I could be doing a whole lot of other stuff." And he would laugh. So Roddy Garvin told me that week in Mobile, he says, "Ole loves you." He's like, "You just say it right back to him, he loves it." You know, which him and Garvin had that relationship where they would just blister each other and go on about their day. And, you know, it was funny to watch. But Charlie Smith, my dear friend that we lost a couple years ago, who, you know, was involved in the Georgia Wrestling Office all the way back to like 1948, he always said, if you got to know Ole away from wrestling, yeah, he was always gruff. No matter what, he was gruff and, you know, whatever. But he was a good guy. And up until Ole just physically got to where he couldn't get out and go, and then Smitty got that way. Smitty was older than Ole. Smitty was in his 90s. But they would go have lunch together every Wednesday and just sit there and talk. He used to call Handsome Jimmy. And you know, you talk about two complete opposites in Jimmy Valiant and Ole Anderson. You know, one of them's cussing and screaming all the time and just miserable, and the other one's always upbeat and loves everybody. But Ole would call Jimmy and they would talk, and I asked Jimmy one time, I says, "Well, out of all the people, why does he call you?" And he goes, "Because I listen." He's like, "I like him." He's like, I know him. I know what he is. I know how he, but he goes, "He was good to me." And he had booked Jimmy and Johnny in Atlanta as a team off that New York run. Then he booked Jimmy different times in Atlanta. You know, he gave Jimmy the Boogie Woogie Man gimmick. So, you know, when you hear Ole's name, everybody automatically thinks of this mean, miserable person. But they don't give him the credit for what a draw that he was, what a talent he was, and what a brilliant booker he was. Now, I believe that his last stance of booking WCW probably tarnished that a little bit with some people, but it was an entirely different business by that WCW run. It's a corporate business. It's a show business of what they were trying to do. It wasn't the old time wrestling. But here's something. I don't think this can be said about anybody else other than Ole Anderson. He was booking two major NWA territories at the same time. He was booking Atlanta and the Carolinas at the same time. Five towns a night, three in the Mid-Atlantic territory, two in Atlanta territory. So he's running five crews. He's booking angles. He's writing the TVs. He's booking bringing the talent in and out. I couldn't imagine how hard that had to be. time consuming that was. But then also figure in, he's working on top in both territories to say on top of booking them. So what a mind for the wrestling business, because both of them were doing business at that time.
And that's the thing that, you know, that some people always said, you know, why didn't he go anywhere else? And it's like, well, why would you? It's like, if you're the booker in, like, two of the biggest territories in the country and main eventing, and, you know, he's, I think, sort of what people say is, you know, in the mid-70s or late-70s, he's making, like, $100,000, like, more than $100,000 in 1970s money.
Yeah.
It's like, why would you? It's like, you know, that's always the thing. It's like, you know, that's a knock they use against some people. And it's like, well, if you're successful and it's a job, you know, which a lot of times people nowadays forget, it's like, you know, like if you were some sort of like corporate guy and you're running like a Fortune 500 company, like, do you run it for like a year and say, oh, I've done this, let me go jump from IBM to Chrysler or whatever just because you want something different to do? Or do you want to keep doing the job that you're doing well and keep making your money?
And he also took that money and invested it in property and in a sawmill. He had property in Toccoa, Georgia. He had property in Minnesota. So he was successful with those dealings also. And, you know, he never left. He only worked two territories. He only worked, you know, he might have worked Knoxville for a little bit. Well, why should he? You know, they say the same thing about Ron, Don, and Whitey here in East Tennessee. Well, they didn't leave. Well, yes, they did leave. They would go work for Mr. Crockett. They would go work for Nick and Roy. But they were the bread and butter of this territory, just like Lawler in Memphis, just like Lonnie Mane on the West Coast, just like Johnny Weaver in Charlotte. I mean, right, they're getting to sleep in their own bed every night. They're getting to see their kids and their family more than most of the boys. So if you can do it, homestead and make that money, you're very blessed and very smart.
And if you're there long enough to get points in the office, then you definitely don't want to leave.
Right. I mean, it's business sense. But like you said, most people don't look at it as a business. Why would he want to, say, go to Dallas? Let's say Ole just says one day, I want to go to Dallas to see if I can get over. What if he goes to Dallas and he don't get over? Or the office doesn't use him in the position to get over. And now he's lost money as far as being a top draw. He's only, you know, bottom to middle, making that kind of money in a smaller territory where he could work in the same position with Atlanta with his points and his stuff. And he's still making $1,500, $2,000 a week. It's dollars and cents, and Ole was very smart about that. And, I mean, he was a traditionalist wrestler of pound and grab a hold and work that hold and get that heat. But also, he came up with the Road Warriors. He came up with the Boogie Woogie Man. I mean, and I'm sure that there was probably other gimmicks and other things that he came up with that we don't realize was his, because they were so completely different than his persona and his character and his whatever you want to call it, that you don't realize that came from the mind of Ole Anderson.
And like you said, unfortunately, we don't have the footage. I mean, with a lot of sort of the way history has tended to view people, especially in the 80s, it's like, if you were a star in the 70s and we only got to see the tail end of you in the mid to late 80s when everything exploded, then that's like your lasting memory. You know, unfortunately, you know, you talk about how all the great booking he may have done in the 70s and Crockett in Georgia. It's like, yeah, we remember, you know, the Black Scorpion and Junkyard Dog feuding with Flair in like 1990, you know, and all these other sort of horrible, you know, gimmicks that he came up with while, you know, having to work under Jim Herd. So it's not even like he had ultimate creative control. And a lot, you know, you hear people tell the stories, it was kind of like, you know, he's also trying to book and save them money at the same time by using all of these green guys. But it's the kind of thing where if you were the guy who took two green Minnesota bouncers to turn them into the Road Warriors, I'm sure he probably thought, you know, what's to say that doesn't happen again with Sid or with Brian Clark as the Night Stalker? You know what I mean? It could have worked. Yeah. You know, I mean, you know, and Sid is Sid and, you know, has his own weird charisma anyway. But, you know,
Herd told him to make the new Road Warriors. So that's where the Master Blasters came from. Kevin Nash and whoever Kevin's partner was, you know, they're trying to catch lightning in a bottle twice. Animal and Hawk were the perfect people to be the Road Warriors. No one else could bend the Road Warriors other than them. Nobody.
And it's funny too that he also ended up with the right two guys, because you know, in theory, the Road Warriors could have been Barry Darsaw and Rick Rude, and that wouldn't have worked.
Right.
Probably. You know what I mean? It's the fact that Animal and Hawk were perfect for that gimmick, and Rick Rude, it turned out, was sort of perfect for the gimmick that Rick Rude eventually had, but he probably wouldn't have worked as one of the Road Warriors.
Yeah. And, I mean, here's another thing that a lot of people do not realize. Ole made the first red-hot national superstar, Tommy Wildfire Rich, with that cable TV. Right place, right time, right guy. But if it didn't have the right angles, the right booking, the right stuff, it wouldn't have worked. And he had Ole pulling the strings, and Ole saw something, and Barnett and Ole both saw something in Tommy that a lot of other people did not see. And man, they made him a household name in the late 70s and early 80s off of that TBS. And would, you know, TBS starts going into all these markets and all these places that either didn't have wrestling, like Ohio and Northern West Virginia. I mean, they still had the Sheik and a little bit, but the territory was dead. Sheik had killed it. And they set it on fire. Michigan, Ohio, West Virginia. If it was anybody else booking the product at that time, would it have gotten over the way it got over? I don't think it would have. And the Wrestling 2 and the Superstar, Tommy and Buzz, all these great angles that people remember from Georgia Championship Wrestling, they were Ole Anderson. They were a creation from his mind. And they made a lot of money with it. But by 83, he's fighting the battle of, you know, he's now the boss, the one in control, and that whole thing was a mess, and Vince is starting to expand. Crockett's starting to expand. He doesn't have the talent that he had a year earlier. And your booking is only as good as the talent you have. And you have, if you're a booker, you have to have a crew that understands your vision, what you're doing, what you see. and they could go out there and perform to the highest level and make it happen. And Ole didn't have that by 84. And then he's in a horrible time slot after Vince gets 6:05. He's on at like 8 o'clock in the morning on Saturday mornings. But he was still making a go of it with that time slot and what he had to offer.
And we're lucky here that, you know, another thing that we could thank Ole for is bringing Georgia to Baltimore. And, yeah. You know, which would turn out to become, you know, one of Jim Crockett's best cities when they started expanding. And, you know, because luckily the way people in Baltimore and the people in Philadelphia are, you know, they, I would say smartly, you know, preferred the NWA Southern style to certainly at that point, the WWF cartoon style. I mean, they were certainly, yeah. I mean, they certainly drew in both places, but you know, the fact that, you know, they could very well outdraw the WWF in the Civic Center in Baltimore, or maybe they could come close in the Civic Center in Philly to what Vince was doing at the Spectrum, you know, that, and that last,
they even ran head to head there a few times with both of them drawing big houses.
Right, but I mean, I can definitely see why the gritty NWA style, you know, fit Baltimore very well, because, you know, that's just the kind of, you know, I'm sure if, when Mike gets around to listening to this and Greg gets around to listening to this, they'll both agree that, you know, that's just, you know, that's Baltimore for you. You know, I certainly knew that when I was working, you know, when I did stuff for the independent companies in the 90s, you know, I know what kind of style Baltimore likes, and they like the grim and gritty. You know, it's like, oddly enough, and, you know, Maryland is that weird thing where you're hamstrung by the commission.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like, when you can get away with doing stuff, you know, I had explained to somebody recently when I worked for the company in Baltimore, the only time I ever remember us having blood on a show was when we ran on one of the Army bases, because they are not under the jurisdiction of the State Athletic Commission. So they were allowed to use the blade because the Athletic Commission... Now, the Athletic Commission wasn't happy when they heard about it, but they really couldn't... But they could, you know, you can't do anything about it. So, you know, I remember we had a cage match that got juice, and there may have been, like, juice in another match and everything, but, you know, that's how the people in Baltimore like it. And so when, you know, in 1984 or 1983, when they get to see the Road Warriors and get to see Ron Garvin and Jake Roberts and people like that, you know, they instantly fell in love with that style.
And it was money everywhere. I've always heard many stories about Ole, of how he booked and how he did stuff. I've always wondered where Gene fit in to the booking. You know, like JJ was Dusty's detail man, where Dusty would have the big picture, but JJ would fine-tune it and say, okay, it needs to be done like this, with him standing there and him over there. You know, did Gene do that for Ole, or was it all Ole? I've always wondered about that, because Gene is really the only person that ever traveled with Ole. I don't think Ole ever really rode with anybody else, or anybody else ever really rode with him. I know he and Garvin in Florida in the early 70s traveled together some. But, you know, he had to have somebody to bounce ideas off of in the car. Of what do you think of this? What if we did this? And it had to be Gene Anderson. I mean, who else would it have been?
I mean, knowing the people that he was, I mean, if you sort of say who he usually worked with, then you could say maybe Stan or maybe Ivan, you know, because they seem like they were always, you know, they were always part of his troupe when they were available, that, you know, he used them in multiple places.
But, he used Edie. You know, same thing with Bill. He used Bill. But, yeah, there had to be somebody there that was that core group that was pitching ideas and listening to ideas.
But I wonder, when you say that, then I wonder if Ole's booking was affected once Gene had his stroke. You know, so that maybe he's not traveling with him as much, or maybe he's not, you know, not giving him everything that he used to, you know, maybe that could also be part of it too.
Yeah, that's a real good possibility. But you know, he was such a powering. Like, when Ole walked in a room, you knew Ole was there. You know, he just had that presence of him. And he could laugh at himself, and he could laugh at other stuff. I saw that in Mobile. You don't hear about that. He told us a story one time in Mobile at the reunion about how he had went to see Lou Thesz. He respected the heck out of Lou Thesz and everything that Lou was about. And he says to Lou, "Hey, show me some hooks. I'd like to learn something." You know, and Ole's probably in his early 50s at this time, so Lou was probably, you know, in his late 60s. So Lou goes, "Well, let's go in the wrestling room." And he goes in there in the mat, and he says, "Okay, Ole, the first thing you have to do is expect the unexpected." And he headbutted Ole in the nose hard. And Ole was definitely not expecting that. So when he did it, then Lou grabbed him and hooked him in something. And Ole, he laughed about it. He told the story and laughed that Lou got him. So he had to have a sense of humor that very few people saw, because think about the story they tell about the Shockmaster falling through the wall, and then Ole has to do the voice, but he's trying not to laugh. And then once he gets doing the voice, they said he fell on the floor laughing. had Fred Ottman taking the face bump through the wall. So he wasn't always as serious as everybody thought that he was. But he had to be serious. He had to be the boss. He had to be demanding, because he had Barnett to answer to. He had other stockholders. He had the Crockett family to answer to. So he had to produce money, and nothing but money. And for a long period of time, he did that. He produced money.
Well, I know there's that story that Cornette always tells about when they're doing the Bash tour in 86, and, you know, Ole's like underneath teaming with Arn on various things. And then like a lot of the main events are Flair's match, but it's also like Baby Doll and Partners versus the Midnights. And he said something about, you know, like having to work underneath like the girl and the fat manager, although he didn't say girl, but you know, and then Cornette just says, you know, like, on behalf of the girl and the fat manager, I'd like to thank you for how much money we're making here. Yeah, which again popped Ole, and probably, you know, went on the way, you know, especially because, you know, he had probably whatever bad memories he had of Cornette from the Chattanooga thing.
Right.
That you know, is like now sort of like so bad it's fun to watch, But, you know, when they tried to start that, you know, they were trying to make it, you know, a deal of it, but it was just, you know, right, wrong time, wrong place, wrong people. I think it lasted like 6 or 8 weeks or something like that.
Yeah, but he didn't give them, he gave them a TV in the towns, but no money, no budget, and no help, because he was worried about Ohio and Michigan. It was doomed from the beginning. Hassam tells the story about becoming the boogeyman. Hassam had got booked in Jacksonville, where Don Curtis was trying to open up, was it called Sunbelt or Suncoast Wrestling? He's trying to open a territory up inside of Eddie Graham's territory. And they use Roop, Austin Idol, Jimmy Valiant, Malenko. It was some of the guys that were a part of the split in Knoxville. They were trying to get into Florida. But anyways, Jerry Jarrett calls Hassam and says, "Jimmy, what are you doing? If you don't get out of there, you're going to get blackballed. You and Idol have got to get out of there right now." And he says, "Where do I go? What can I do?" And Jarrett says, "Give me a few minutes and I'll call you back." So Jarrett calls back and he tells Hassam, he goes, "I got two places you can go. You can go to Louisiana or you can go to Charlotte. And you either one of them, you start Monday." And Hassam had been in Louisiana years before with Leroy McGuirk. And he said, "Well, I've already been there and I didn't like it. The trips were, you know, because no interstates, it was just bad." He goes, "I've never been to Charlotte. I'll go to Charlotte." So he gets to Charlotte and Ole makes him King James Valiant and puts Alfred Hayes as his manager. So he's working and he's teaming with Valentine some, but Jerry Jarrett keeps calling, wanting, "Can I get Hassam on this date? Can I get Hassam on this date? Can we use Hassam on?" So finally, Ole, one Wednesday, they're in there to do interviews, and Ole asks Jimmy, he says, "Jim, why does Jerry Jarrett want you on all these Memphis nights?" And he goes, "Well, I'm over pretty good there, you know, as a baby face." And Ole looks at him and goes, "Baby face?" Because Ole knew him as one of the Valiant brothers. And he goes, "Baby face? Why didn't you tell me you were a hot baby face?" And Hassam goes, "You never asked me. That's why." Which popped Ole. It made Ole laugh. And Ole comes back a few minutes later and he says, "Hey, can you grow a beard?" And he's like, "Yeah." He said, "I had different gimmick beards and this." And he goes, "Don't shave. Don't cut your hair. I'm thinking about something." And as they're talking in the office, Manhattan Transfer's boy from New York City came on the radio. And Ole said, "You're going to come to the ring to that song." And then he just starts laying out the boogeyman, the street people. They send him to Memphis on Mondays for 3 weeks. He comes back to TV, and if you remember, the first day on TV is the boogeyman. He beats up Ole Anderson, Stan Hansen, and Ivan Koloff, and dances off, and he's made. He's a superstar in Charlotte and ends up getting an unbelievable 7-year run there. And that was all from Ole being able to think on his feet and come up with something real quick. And it was probably because Jimmy fired back at him saying, "Hey, you never asked me. That's why." You know, he didn't, if you wouldn't argue back with Ole, if you wouldn't stand up to Ole, how would he expect you to stand up to the fans? This is a man that had been cut and stabbed 3 times. The guy that had fought fans for years. So he knew, if I'm going to put you in that position to draw that kind of money, you got to be able to handle yourself. And if you won't stand up to me, how are you going to stand up to 25 people at ringside trying to cut you and punch you? He would test the wrestlers. Pez Watley got his job in Atlanta and got his push because Ole said a racial slur to Pez, and Pez took him down right there in the hallway on the ground. And Ole said, good for you. If you can't handle me saying stuff to you, how are you going to handle the fans saying it? If you're going to be able to, if you can't fight me, how are you going to fight the people? And that's how Ole, but he made Pez a babyface. And he had a way of testing everybody, and he definitely tested everybody that ever worked for him because he was a taskmaster. But here's the other thing that everybody says about Ole. He was a very good payoff man, and they made money with him. So if you performed to his liking and to his level and you drew the house, he took care of you for it. But he was going to test you, and he was going to make you earn it.
Which, in a way, is not too dissimilar to someone he once teamed with years and years ago in the AWA, and that's the Cowboy. I mean, they're very, I mean, a lot of the guys from that era are very similar, you know, and he definitely, you know, they're definitely cut from the same cloth.
Yeah. And I want to say this because I mentioned what he said to Pez. I've heard people say since his passing that Ole was a racist, this, this, and this. I've seen a couple people post that, and I've had a couple people say that to me. His best friend was Thunderbolt Patterson. I don't believe he could be too racist and him and Thunderbolt be as tight as they were all through the years.
Especially given who Thunderbolt was.
Yeah. He, Junkyard Dog, liked Ole Anderson. And Ole liked Dog. Like we said earlier, he gave Dog the run with Flair. It was too late, you know, for Dog in Dog's career. But he also gave him some good runs in Atlanta years earlier. He gave Pez that job. I mean, there was a lot of African-American stars that Ole helped make in Charlotte and in Atlanta. King Parsons and Pork Chop Cash, the first black Mid-Atlantic tag team champions. Ole brought them there from different territories, put them together, and made them the champions. Because he believed in them, and he believed they would draw money. So some of the stuff that Ole is credited with or credited of being, he's not, and he was not. Was he a complete asshole? Yes. Yes, he was. Did he have to be? Yes, he did. Did he have to be to the extent that he was? No. But, you know, he was successful, and everybody that he worked for and dealt with will tell you that, and they all will tell you that he helped make them more successful.
And one of the things that we haven't mentioned yet, which I would certainly put as one of his best things in the business, is what a great color guy he was, especially working with Gordon on the Georgia TV.
Yeah.
It's like he was certainly an early, like, heel commentator. Like, I'm sure he was certainly a heel commentator on the Georgia TV before Roddy Piper was.
Yeah.
And Piper's the one that seems to, you know, and Piper's the one that gets credit for it. But also, that was under Ole.
Yeah. And also Piper is from the VCR era. Only was a little before the VCR. I mean, he had the Horseman run VCR time, but most of the Minnesota Wrecking crew was pre-VCRs. And as a babyface, when he was the office guy and he would come out and speak about events and what was going on and do those things with Ole, he was with Gordon Solie, you know, putting an angle over or doing color. And that he was great in that role, too.
Well, I was going to say that's another way he's like Watts in that, and you probably know this, that a lot of times the best color guy you can have is the booker because he's the one that's able to explain what you need to, what the audience needs to know. And the fact he's like, you know, one of the best talkers, you know, of the modern era doesn't hurt. So he can get over what he needs to get over while also staying in his character, which also helps being the like very bright, articulate, although a jerk, you know, he's going to tell you exactly what you need to know. And then that carried over to his promos, you know, when he's, you know, talking, you know, again, you know, everybody's been watching the 1980 turn, you know, which is like brilliant long-term booking, you know, that, you know, a turn months in the making and all these seeds are sown. And, you know, and then when it finally happens, it's brilliant. And then he, you know, and then Dusty repeats it 5 years later when the Horsemen do it.
Yeah.
In the same building.
Yeah.
Which is that's the almost the best part of that angle is not only how, you know, it's repeated in again, you know, it's that thing about, you know, you repeat an angle every 5 to 7 years because your audience is turned over or, you know, like that. But to do like almost the exact same angle, like in the same building and get almost the same reaction. Cause I mean, I think both of those turns were so great. They had fans climbing the cage to get in.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was definitely a fan, like, because that's right around when I started watching. I started watching Crockett stuff in, like, the summer of 1985, like, almost the perfect time to start watching Crockett. But, you know, not surprisingly, I immediately became a heel fan. And I remember, I guess, you know, so I would have been, like, 15 or 16. And again, to show how much I liked the Horsemen, although they weren't the Horsemen yet, I remember we went to the mall and we went to the t-shirt place where you had your, you know, your custom t-shirts made. And I had my own evil, mean, and nasty t-shirt made, like the kind that Ole wore on Crockett TV.
Yeah, he had that one. He had the one that said, "Damn, I'm good." I'm trying to think if he had any others. My first, like I said earlier, my first memory was him and Gene, you know, him. And I think it was Paul Jones running his head into Gene and that.
It is.
I was a little boy when that happened. But the first program that I really remember only being in at Mid-Atlantic was when Ray Stevens was teaming with him. And he went to do the same thing to Ray. He tried to throw the opponent into Ray, and Ray told him, "Hey, don't ever do that." He's like, "You know, I'm not getting injured for you." And then he did it on TV, and Ray's down selling, and Ray gets up and makes a comeback on Ole. And I believe that was like 81. And, you know, Ole was very good about bringing stuff from the past and inserting it where the fans that, like you said, there was turnover every 5 to 7 years or whatever, but there was always that hardcore class of wrestling fans that were going to watch no matter what, no matter how long, and they would remember that kind of stuff. And you know, it's like he did the 86 when he came back and jumped Dusty. And they had to bleep it out or where he said, this ain't over until one of us is dead. And they played on the history of Dusty and Ole, all, you know, for that. Ole was very good about bringing stuff back around where he would have guys and they would work programs. And then like Superstar in Wrestling too, they would separate for months. And then all of a sudden they're right back at it again because we have unfinished business from before. And that's another sign of a great booker. Well, and
certainly Mid-Atlantic had the advantage of having a lot of those guys who may, you know, like leave for a time and then come back. But for like, you know, that 10-year period, it seemed like you always had the Andersons, you had Flair, you had Valentine, Paul Jones, and then eventually you had Steamboat. So, you know, you can have the thing where, okay, Ole and Gene team with Flair, and then they feud, you know, once Flair and Valentine become a team and they feud, and then it cools off, and then they're then they team again, and then they, you know, it's sort of like Memphis in that way, where you, when you have those people who are always there, you can mix and match, and the long-term fans know. Sometimes they're a team, and sometimes they fight. You know what I mean? That it can go either way, and you could and you can conceivably flip alignments too, where you, like in Memphis, like sometimes Lawler's the heel and Dundee's the babyface, and sometimes Dundee's the heel and Lawler's the babyface.
And it also goes to not just credit Ole, but credit that crew of guys to how good they were. To, like you said, guys like Paul Jones and Wahoo and Valentine and Flair and Steamboat and Andersons were there for so long, and they continued to draw money the entire time they were there. And it never really got stale. Business never dropped because they all were great at their job.
Definitely. But yeah, and it's a shame that we have so little of like that 70s, you know, like we have the so-called garbage tapes, you know, where we get little snippets of it, but
yeah.
And you know, who knows what they have in the vault in Connecticut now from
what,
or you know, from WC, you know, from Georgia or from Croc, you know, it's like they somehow found the Battle of Atlanta, which we all thought was lost forever. So who knows what may eventually turn up?
Let me tell you what my dear friend Bobby Simmons told me a couple years ago when that Battle of Atlanta came out. Bobby was the office manager for Barnett, and then he worked for Ole for a short time when Ole took over, and they just butted heads because he was a Barnett guy, and Ole treated everybody differently than Barnett did. But Bobby told me that one day, Barnett was saying something about these tapes and these films we have, and they're taking up room in there, and what are we going to do with them, and do we throw them out or what? And Ole said, Bobby, you and Randy go this week and go through them and log everything that's there. There may be something in there we want to keep. And Bobby Simmons and Randy Corin went through every piece of film and video and labeled them and what it was and what they had. And then Ole took them, and nobody knew where they went to after that. And just like, I don't know, maybe within the last 10 years, because Smitty was still alive and able to get around and do stuff. Ole called Charlie Smith one day and said, come over here. I want to give you something. And Smitty went over there, and Ole gave him a box of tapes. And they were the beta tapes. And it was no, I don't think there was any full, there was a couple of WCW, not from the Turner time. There was a few of those on there that were like international syndication. But then there was some older stuff in there, but nothing in full or nothing. Because they called me and I, like, is this out? Everything that was on those tapes and stuff that's out there now. But it's hard to tell where all the other stuff went to. I mean, is it sitting at Ole's house? You know, is Marcia going to uncover stuff now that we're not going to be able to believe what they have found? Or is it sadly lost forever?
Or it's just in the hands of tape traders who, like, still have stuff but haven't bothered putting it out there or sold it or whatever, and it's not going to be until they decide to get rid of their collection or whatever, then it pops up, like, in another 10 years. Like, you know, there are definitely, like, people around who have stuff that isn't out in circulation.
Right.
That is somehow going to, like, eventually appear out of the blue, seemingly.
I don't know if you ever saw this. What was the, I'm trying to think of it. Was it called Turner South? Was that the channel?
Yeah, there was. Yeah, there was, like, an that, cause that's his, because, like, eventually they got Braves games because it was, like, a subsidiary of TBS or, you know, of Turner. But it was, like, another channel for them to put stuff on.
Yeah, and Dusty had a classic wrestling show on Sunday nights on Turner South. And they showed Georgia TVs off the Masters on there. So I'm imagining all of that stuff is in Connecticut and will never be seen.
Right.
Because I've probably still got a few of those off Turner South on VHS in here somewhere. But they would show matches from TBS studios from the late 70s and early 80s on there. And I remember watching it thinking, what do they still have? You know, my gosh, if they're showing you this stuff on broadcast TV now and it looks this good, that means they still have the Masters. And we've got the Crockett, you know, they put all the Crockett Masters out there, the Saturday night shows. So how far back did they actually have the Masters of the Saturday night shows?
And they haven't even put up, like, all of the Crockett stuff that we know they have.
Yeah.
You know, like, either the TBS stuff or the syndicated stuff, because, you know, certainly on the Saturday night stuff, there's big holes in that they don't have on the network that presumably they own or have or both. But,
yeah.
But you just never know. It's sort of like, you know, a couple years ago when, you know, that stuff that Les had magically showed up on YouTube.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, and we both know Les is like, who knows what else Les still has? You might have a good idea, but you know what I mean? Who knows what hidden gems he has? And if he has, it's like, well, you know, it's like, who only knows how much stuff Cornette has? Like, either his own stuff or... Because, I mean, I asked him that once that they spent, like, a half an hour talking about this on their show about, you know, sort of, like, what's in his library and sort of, like, what's the legacy of his collection going to be? You know what I mean? Because, you know, there's lots of Memphis stuff that he probably has that he directly, like, taped from the Masters at WMC that, you know, there are these holes in Memphis stuff that we don't have on YouTube or anybody has that he has. You know, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if, like, Sullivan has stuff. You know what I mean? There's, like, certain people that have been around forever, but you also know that have worked in TV that sort of know the value of stuff.
Yeah.
Who, you know, and even, you know, maybe Kevin has that Knoxville stuff when it was, you know, like the Knoxville TV that he did just so his kids could watch. You know, maybe.
And he has to. I mean, because that there's that stuff on YouTube that goes through all that. And I've wondered if he made that tape, you know, that you see out there on YouTube, that's him in the studio and all that, because that's in Knoxville. Kevin would be the only person that would actually have that.
That's why this is like such a fascinating thing to like be a historian of. It's like, you know, I know a lot about comic books, but it's kind of like, you know, there aren't really, unless you're talking about way into the 40s, you know what I mean? Anything from like the 60s onward, you know, you can eventually find a copy of something. You know, something is not lost to history the way it is with like wrestling and other kinds of TV, you know, because it wasn't recorded because people didn't see the value of it. It's the same. I mean, we were talking on the pod a couple of shows ago, like we were talking about like Doctor Who was like this. And a lot of British shows from the 60s and 70s are like that they weren't saved. But yet with Doctor Who, it's this weird thing where, because it was the BBC and they showed it all around the world, like, they found episodes from the 60s that the BBC doesn't have anymore in the vaults and TVs in Australia. And in fun, and this is like a running joke, but like lots of TV stations in Africa, they've turned up episodes of Doctor Who from the 60s. Because they just still had it. And like, wow. The people that made it didn't have it. But I mean, it's kind of like, you know, like, yes, the WWF doesn't have, like, these TV shows from, like, 1978, but yet there's a guy in, you know, there's a guy in Memphis who, or Buddy Rose, like, how much of the Portland stuff would we not have if Buddy hadn't been taping his own stuff and had, like, one of the world's first VCRs?
Yeah. I mean, and was smart enough to save all of it for all of those years. Knowing that, hey, sometime somebody will want to see this, and some way there will be a way to upgrade it and save it and, you know, keep putting it out there.
And the funny thing about that is, I don't know if you're like this, but I am. Sometimes if I'm watching like old stuff from like the 80s or whatever, it weirds me out to see it in, like, crystal clear TV that, like, I kind of need to watch it a little fuzzy with a little ghosting and a little striping on it. You know what I mean? It doesn't feel right to, like, watch this pristine, like, 1981 footage.
It's the first time I saw Andy Griffith on a 4K TV, it freaked me out. I was like, what the heck? You know, I was like, and it's black and white, but it was so clear and so, you know, vivid and just like, gosh. And that I was talking to my nephew Waylon. We were talking about wrestling, and I was telling him what I had to do as a kid to see wrestling before we got cable, and how I would mess with the antennas and trying to pick it up, and if it was raining real hard or snowing real hard, I could get Channel 10 out of Knoxville. Sometimes we could get Channel 13 out of Asheville. If everything lined up just perfectly right, we could get the channel out of Spartanburg. It would be fuzzy and, you know, hard to see, but you could hear it. And I was telling him about, sometimes I would just stand there and listen to them read the card off. What was the guy's name that used to come on and tell you off the Spartanburg TV? It would have the drawing of the guy with the chin lock on the guy, and the guy would say, hey, this is whoever to tell you about this Monday night in Spartanburg. But I would, every now and then, again, I could get the audio to come in just enough to hear that. And I would listen. And if I was able to see it now, it probably would not be as exciting as it was just being able to hear it all those years later, or years ago.
Well, I know this
because it was so exciting to find something that you weren't supposed to see.
I know this
through.
I know this. I know this is something that Mike's talked about, but I think somewhere in the house I have like audio tapes where I would tape people doing promos, because it was like I didn't want to like waste the VCR tape, because VCR tapes used to be expensive.
Yeah.
So it's like so like I have like audio tapes of promos and stuff, but like I don't have the video anymore. So it's like if I ever find those, you know, I'll find a way to like put them up. But you know, that's the kind of thing. It's like I kind of wish, you know, maybe I had been a little more, I had not been so cheap and like this, like the 6 months of like 1985 Crockett TV, I don't have edited down to like one VCR tape. It's like, why didn't I save, you know, I did not save all these squash mashes. You know, it's like I have, you know, a handful of like Midnight Express squash matches and some like, you know, horseman or proto horseman matches, but like, and then some promos, but I didn't save everything because it was like, well, I'm just going to save the guys I like, and I'm not going to bother with, you know, this CM Houston Gene Liggett match,
right.
You know, or the Thunder Feet versus, you know, Rocky King and Ricky Nelson. You know, the world does not, this does not need saved for posterity. But just those decisions you make. But we talked about how Ole passed away. I don't know, what kind of interactions over the years did you have with Mike Jones, a.k.a. Virgil?
I was in a few towns with Mike in the 90s, maybe a couple more in the early 2000s. I was on an Ohio loop for Bobby Fulton with Mike that for different reasons turned out to be kind of legendary for the other ones of us that were on there. And this was in 96. I think it was 96. It was supposed to be Valentine. And we're in Gallipolis, Ohio at the fair, and it's like a rodeo arena where we're wrestling in the middle of it. We dress back in the press box and in the area back behind there. So we're a good ways away from the people. And I'm standing there talking to Bobby Fulton. It's early in the day, and Bobby looks and he goes, "Hey, who's that guy carrying a bag?" And I'm looking, I mean, I can barely see him. He's way over there. I was like, "I don't know." And he goes, "Is that Virgil? Why is Virgil here?" And he jumps the fence and takes off running. And now they're way over on the other side of the fair, but I can still hear Bobby. And I hear Bobby go, "No." And he comes back, and it was a Tuesday night. And we had fairs all that week for Bobby. And Tuesday was the first night. Well, Monday night, I saw Valentine on Nitro. And I knew, well, if he's at Nitro, he ain't making Bobby's towns. So Greg had called and told Virgil to make the towns for him, come over from Pittsburgh. So he went and so whatever. So it ends up being Virgil in his spot. Well, there was two minis on there, two little guys, Ripley Von Slam and Bad Boy Buck. And I guess Virgil had, somewhere in his career, he had to be around little people. I mean, you know, he was around Dink, wasn't he? I mean, but he did not know how to interact with the little guys. And he didn't know, like, whether to talk to them as the boys or he didn't know. So he would walk by, and if they'd be sitting there, he would reach down and go, "I got your belly." He would treat them like children. Which was so funny. But it wasn't funny to them. And, I mean, he did it several times. So, Ripley Von Slam, at WrestleCade, had someone go sign a picture, have Virgil sign a picture for him and sign on there, "I got your belly." But, nice enough guy. I saw him, you know, with Soul Train Jones in Memphis. I was watching the TV because we had the Memphis TV here. So I saw that run, and then, boom, all of a sudden he's on the New York TV. He was always a nice guy when I was around him. I mean, never any issue. I never saw him give a promoter any issue. Bobby says, "Hey, do this. You're going to lose." Okay. I worked with him. I never had a match. So I was never in a ring with him, but I was around him, and I mean, he was there to do his job, get his money and go home and be safe about doing it. And, you know, the one thing to me that speaks out about Virgil is, how long did that guy have a job? Between his WCW run and his New York run, how long were those? Because, like, wouldn't New York be from, like, 87 to, what, like, 94?
Probably.
So, like, 7 years there, and then he went over to WCW, you know, in the NWO era, and got probably what, another 5 or 6 years out of that.
Well, and in his case, it certainly paid for people to associate you with being like the lackey or the stooge, because like a heel is always going to need like a stooge. Yeah. And if you're like the guy people immediately think of, you know, and it certainly helps that it's like, okay, you know, he's memorable from all these years in the WF TV, and because, you know, his name as a rib on Dusty, that it's like, okay, well, like, he comes in to WCW, and then they name him Vince, you know, to take the shot back, and then eventually they rename him Shane. Which,
yeah,
like,
I forgot about that. Yeah,
and then he becomes Curly Bill as part of the West Texas Rednecks, and most people probably don't realize that Curly Bill is actually like an inside wrestling rib name. You know, they just think it sounds funny. You know, that like it sounds like a Gabby Hayes kind of Western sidekick name, not realizing like there's actually like a historic, you know, wrestling joke in there. But again, you know, yeah, if it's, you know, as long as the checks are being cleared, it's like, you know, you don't mind being the stooge or the made to look stupid or always the butt of the joke. It's, you know, as long as, of course, the WCW guys are getting paid to not show up. I guess that's the best thing. The best thing is to get your check to not have to leave your house. The next best thing is, you know, I mean, you think about it, how long was he in the WWF with DiBiase before he even had to wrestle?
Right.
You know, I mean, most of the times he just stood there. So he didn't even have to work. So, you know,
because that picture went around of Virgil with no line, you know, here's Virgil. And if you hang around a convention long enough, you will have 10 seconds to take a picture of anybody there like that.
Or you just say, "Hey, everybody, hold on a second," and then you take the picture. I mean, right. I mean, that's why it was a great gimmick. Because, again, it was him making fun of himself, or, you know, Or he was in on the joke, even if like it wasn't his idea. He played into it, which is smart.
And he was smart. And he never took himself too serious because he knew it was a business, and he was there to make money. And like I said, I've never had anybody say, "Oh, I hate that guy," ever. I've never heard anybody say that. I've never heard anybody say, "Oh, I have heat with him," or "I want to fight him," or "I wanted this," or "I wanted that." And everywhere that I ever was at with him, and it wasn't a whole lot of places, but anywhere I was there and he was there, the wrestling fans definitely knew who he was. And he got a reaction coming out. And, you know, he was able to do it and make a good living for a long time. And more power to him. Well, and he was always, the few times that I was around him, he was always upbeat and happy. You know, he always come over, "Hey, I'm Mike, nice to meet you." You know, the guy running the town would say, "This is what I need. Okay, I'll get it done for you the best I can do it." And I tell you who he reminds me of. Another Pittsburgh guy, Downtown Bruno. Bruno's that way. They just have that personality, and they have that, okay, whatever the job is, I will do my best to make it happen. And they love the wrestling business, and I never saw Bruno grab a little guy's belly and go, "I got your belly," though. So that's the only difference.
Well, the two things that I found interesting this week, and again, I don't know, I think they've both been confirmed, but like one, he apparently was actually 10 years older than he told everybody, so he kayfabed his age.
Yeah, I did read that. That kind of shocked me when I saw Zoltan post he was actually this old, not that old.
And that he apparently, I guess maybe after he was done wrestling, he like got a degree in math. So again, not a stupid guy, and
right,
a smart guy, and you know, saved his money and, you know, went on and had the rest of his life. And again, you know, he's like on the card, when he goes to a convention, it's like nobody's going to a wrestling convention to see Virgil. But when you're walking around and it's like, "Hey, there's Virgil," you know, yeah. Again, and, you know, as somebody who's done enough Comic Cons over the years, it's like, you know, when you have a booth like that, and I frequently have had a booth like that, it is nice when people come over to talk to you. So,
yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure he's not smart. He's not charging, you know, $100 for a marked photo or whatever. He's smart enough to know that, you know, Flair charges $100. I'm going to charge 20, and people will be happy that it's like, "Hey, I got my picture with Virgil, and it was only $20 or whatever.
Yeah.
You know? You like, know your place and excel where you are, and you'll keep going.
And he, the other thing is, he seemed to enjoy everything that he did. He had fun with it. And probably because he didn't take himself too serious.
Which is, again, is funny because, you know, his gimmick was being like the no-selling bodyguard guy. So yeah. I'm sure also, I mean, you know, he's one of those guys where I'm sure people loved, especially on house shows, probably to try and crack him up because it went against his gimmick. You know, I'm sure that was like one of those things everybody did every night was, "Can we get him to laugh or something?" Like you can easily see like DiBiase do, or like, I mean, can you imagine like when you're in the, they're in the middle of that feud where it's DiBiase and Dusty, and Dusty certainly got to be like, "Oh, this is the guy they named after me as a rib, you know, right. I'm going to do something to make him laugh that he's not supposed and like maybe the road agent will get mad at him because he laughs in the middle of the ring and he's not supposed to. Like, you can see Dusty doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, and other people.
Yeah.
The one thing we had
on the list of things to talk about, but we were going to talk about the Iron Claw if you had ever actually gotten around to seeing it, because I know we had talked and you had tried watching it on streaming and you weren't able to get it to work that one night. But I figured it'd be interesting for us just to talk about maybe like what you know about it versus actually having seen it. Because I know originally we were going to talk about it when it came out, and you were like, oh, I don't know if I really want to see it. Because it's a thing where it's a docudrama, and I wouldn't say they're fast and loose with history, but they've definitely made some changes that seem to annoy lots of people, which I find interesting because it's a fictionalized version of real people. People think that you have to be historically accurate when you're making a movie.
Okay. And you know this because you know me. I spend a lot of time to document the history of wrestling, but especially in my home area. I've spent the years in the library and now online going through microfilm and now the digitalized stuff of the newspapers. I have hundreds of window cards from throughout the years. Saving the history of the wrestling business is very important to me, and I take it very serious. So the movie, I knew there would be little things that, you know, would drive me nuts. But it's the movie. I get that. If it's on television, on a movie theater, or whatever, it's a work. I get that. But the details are the things that drive me crazy. Just the little details. Like in the movie, Harley Race is right-handed. The Freebird's boots don't match. I saw that in the trailer and I was like, oh, what the heck? And Michael in the movie's got long tights on and he didn't start wearing long tights until 87. Now, this is the kind of stuff that I thought, you know, only me and a handful of people will know it, but it'll drive us nuts. And then I started hearing other stuff about the mom watching Parade of Champions at home on TV when there's that great moment of her on the Texas Stadium field meeting Kerry when he's coming back from the ring. Chris is not in the movie at all because they said the audience couldn't handle another death in the movie. You could have handled Chris's life, sadly, with three or four scenes in the movie and not really added that much extra time on there. But above everything, here's the important thing. Kevin and the family seems to be happy with the movie.
Yeah.
So no one else's opinion matters because Kevin lived it. It's Kevin's story. Okay. Someone told me this the other night. They said it's such a heartbreaking, such a sad, tragic story. And I said, okay, really? Could it not be such a powerful, uplifting story? And they looked at me weird, and I said, is the story of Kevin Von Erich not powerful? He could have followed them. He didn't. He raised the kids, raised the family, took care of the mother, battled on. How much trauma, PTSD, how much stuff does Kevin Von Erich deal with on a daily basis? And he's still standing. And he's still moving What a strong human being that Kevin has to be. There is a old time wrestling saying of misery builds character. What character that man has?
Well, I think because of that's the way the movie is framed, that you're right. That it's ultimately Kevin's story, and not mainly because he's the one that survives. But he also, like, survives in a good way. I mean, he's, you know, because at the end, it's like, you know, it ends with, I assume I can spoil this for you.
Oh, I've heard about the ending. I was told about it by the first person I knew that went to see it.
Okay. But so, like, it, like, ends with him playing, like, in the yard with his kids. And, you know, and they're like, hey, Dad. You know, like, you know, like the two, like one of the, like, I mean, it's now been 3 months since I've seen it, but it's something like, hey, Dad, like, we're brothers, like me and my little brother. But he's like, you know, I used to have all these brothers and I don't have any brothers anymore. And they're like, well, you can be our brother. And they hug and they, like, they're throwing the football around or whatever. So it's like, yeah. I mean, sort of the point of the movie isn't just here's this horrible family where, like, three of the four sons die or four of the five sons die, whatever. It's the fact that, yeah, that the main character, and he's the star, you know, like, survives and, you know, and, you, like, you know, up and downs with the wife, as you would expect, and, you know, and the things with the family, and then you take away, yes, all the little things that are wrong. But, yeah, in the end, like, it's a positive movie. It's just, there's so much of the other stuff. And I think one of the reasons that Kevin likes the movie or, you know, endorses the movie is, one, that's the message. And, two, it really isn't as bad as it could have been. And you tell people this, and they're shocked, and you're like, wait, so, like, he has his horrible father and, like, three of his brothers die and whatever. And I'm like, but the real story is even worse. Like, yeah. Like Fritz, like in the movie, Fritz is very domineering and kind of a bully, but he's not nearly as bad as the real Fritz. Like, you don't, like, I don't think they show in the movie that, like, he's the one that, like, got his kids on the gas. Like, you don't see that, thankfully. You don't.
Right.
Like, you don't really see any of the abuse that I recall off the top of my head. I mean, maybe, like, just, like, stretching and stuff, but not, like, there's, like, no physical abuse. Like, I don't think they've, you know, I think occasionally there have been stories where there may be, like, other kind of stuff going on, but that's never touched on. But, you know, like, sort of other than the fact that, you know, them, you know, forcing Mike to go into the, like, to become a wrestler and then keep wrestling after the brain damage, you know, is bad. And that really happened. But, you know, it could be worse. Like, we didn't see Fritz's fake heart attack angle, thankfully. You know, we didn't see a lot of the bad stuff that we could have seen that you and I know about.
Right.
So in that way, it's not as bad, you know, and you occasionally see people in the movie that are quote unquote affected by the curse. It's like, you know, you see Gino once, like you see, I think you maybe see Chris Adams once, you see Brody once. You know, they're not really like, again, if you and I are watching this, it's like, oh, you know, we're sticking these guys in that are part of the curse, but it's not really part of the movie. It's just, like, they could have been generic opponents, but they wanted to have a guy that sort of looks like Bruiser Brody and a guy that's supposed to be Gina Hernandez. And for your problem with him punching with the wrong hand, the guy who looks like Harley Race is, like, about as good as you're going to find a guy that looks like Harley Race, right, to play Harley Race. I personally didn't hate the guy who played Flair as much as some of the people hate the guy who played Flair. Because, let me put it this way, like, can you imagine if you're an act, like, you're an actor and they say, okay, you have to impersonate Jack Nicholson, and you have to play Jack Nicholson in a movie. Well, everybody's going to compare you to the real Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
So imagine having to be an actor and having to play Ric Flair in a movie. And then also have to do the wrestling scenes. So I thought the guy did about, to me, okay, he didn't sound like Flair, but I thought he did a good job with Flair's cadence, which to me is like sort of the important part of playing Flair.
Yeah.
So I'm like, you know, I can live with that. I know, and then a lot of the other historical stuff, it's like, I understand you only have 2 hours or whatever, but like some of the weird decisions in the movie, like Carrie's motorcycle accident is the night that he wins the world title. That's weird. Like that's combining like three important things all at one time that you don't need to. And then
your 2-year deal.
Like, and they don't really, I think if I remember right in the movie, like, Mike doesn't start wrestling until David's died. So it's kind of like they need him to make up the numbers. Even though he really doesn't want to. And, you know, and his accident, like, gets hand, like, they, I don't even know, like, if they say that it happened in Israel. Like, they're not, they don't specifically say, oh, he took a, you know, he hurt his shoulder in a match with Tim Brooks in Israel, you know. Like, they sort of just say, oh, he gets hurt and then everything. And they kind of dance around, like, I don't think they tell you, like, they say he gets toxic shock, but it's not like, oh, it's because they accidentally left something in his shoulder that led to it. You know what I mean? They don't, and that's probably a legal thing that they wanted to stay away from.
Yeah.
But, like, but, and that, or the thing where they get on ESPN in, like, 1980. But see, the thing is, that annoyed me, but then they're on ESPN and they have the famous world-class graphics. And I'm like, oh, that's cool that they actually replicated the world-class graphics. And I don't like the fact that they have Kerry's accident the night of the world title match, but I think it's cool that when they're back home after that, Kevin is wearing the white jeans that he wore in that six-man match with the Freebirds at Texas Stadium. Like, that's like a nice touch that people wouldn't notice. But I did, and you would. You were like, oh, he's wearing the pants like he's supposed to be. And he may be wearing, like, the cut-off football shirt that he wore in that match. And I'm like, that's a nice touch. But see, it's the kind of thing where it's like, on the whole, I think it's an okay movie. It's like a B-minus movie. It's like, you know, maybe you knock it a little for the historical inaccuracies, but then give it a little plus for some of the little things that they got right that they didn't need to.
Recreating the sportatorium was unbelievable.
Right.
You know, yeah.
And one of the things I was disappointed in, I said if they would have put this little Easter egg in, I would have been so happy, even if it wouldn't have been in the right place. If they, because, like, there's one scene where the Freebirds are, like, walking to the ring and blah, 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 blah. But I would have loved it if they would have put in the scene where Terry Gordy shoves the guy in the cowboy.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's a famous scene that they could have just thrown in there. But only, like, wrestling fans would have gotten it. But, you know, again, it was just funny. I thought that would have been really funny if that would have been in there. But, and, you know, the wrestling I thought was fine. You know, from an outsider's point of view, it didn't look embarrassing. You know, as like some wrestling, you know, you've seen your fair share of wrestling in TV and movies and how bad it can look.
Oh, yeah.
So I guess maybe that's...
I knew when I first heard they were making the movie and stuff, I was like, you know, they're going to get stuff wrong. They're going to do this. But, I mean, I love the old TV series Daniel Boone. With Fess Parker. I love that old show. I loved it when I was a kid. But if you ever really watch it and understand how historically wrong that show was, you know, he had one kid in the TV show, and Daniel Boone actually had several children, you know, different things. I mean, it's just Hollywood. Once they get the right to it, that's why it says based on a true story or true events. As I told you off the air, it's, you know, I was a big fan of the Buford Pusser Walking Tall movies when I was a kid. But when I wrestled in Memphis, we used to go to Selma regularly into McNary County. And I went to the museums and different stuff and would talk to people. But I had already heard Paul Morton talk about what a crooked, no good son of a gun that Buford Pusser really was. And then I heard Jackie Fargo say, oh, he was a terrible, horrible human being. What a terrible man he was. And they all knew him from the wrestling business, in a short time in the wrestling business, and when he was sheriff there. And Fargo said to me and Misty one time, somehow we got to talking about him, and he said, well, you know, Buford killed his wife. Which just floored me. And now, I don't know how much national news it's made, but it made some big news when it first happened here. They exhumed Pauline's body last month, and they're investigating that he killed her and shot himself to cover it up. And there's a whole book out now, and there's a YouTube series called the Buford Pusser, The Other Story, to where they go chronologically in order and just pick the movies apart and all the stuff, and this is what really happened. So once Hollywood gets it, they can make it whatever they want to make it. They can make whoever a hero and whoever a villain and whoever. I'm just happy about the Claw, Iron Claw, that it was made, because it's been talked about since the late 80s. About a movie being made about them. I can remember Kevin talking about it in interviews and stuff years and years and years ago. And they somewhat got the story right. And like you said, it could have been a lot worse and a lot more historically incorrect and everything else. So, like I said, as long as Kevin is happy with it and the family's happy with it, nobody else's opinion matters.
Well, and you know, the funny thing is, you said that, well, this is, as long as you see based on, then you know it's not going to be real. Well, you know, it's entirely possible if we take this movie and we take the WWF Von Erich documentary and put them side by side and find out which has more historical inaccuracies in it, it's very possible that the documentary has more things wrong with it than the movie. Because
whoever lived long writes history.
Well, that, and I mean, I always tell people, I'm like, a documentary does not mean something is true. Like, documentaries are shaped by the people that make it as much as a film is shaped by the writer and director. Especially now, and sort of like the time we live in where everything is polarized. You could take like a simple story and you could say, tell two different people to make a movie, to make a documentary about it. And you could get two entirely different movies depending on their point of view and perspective on the story. Well, and that could be something bland, let alone something controversial the way things are now.
Let's go back to Ole for a second. Bobby Simmons was in the office in Atlanta for years. So was Charlie Smith. And they read Ole's book as soon as it came out. Both of them did. And he saw them right after that, and he said, have you read the book? And both of them said, yes. And he goes, well, what'd you think? And they said, well, thought it was very good. Didn't agree with everything, But that's how you remember it and how you saw it. I remember it a little differently. And that's just going to happen no matter who you're talking to. I mean, how many eyewitness accounts of different events have happened where people can't agree on what exactly just happened, you know, because they all saw it differently from different angles and different sides.
Well, you wrote a book. You wrote a book with Bill Dundee. And I'm sure there are, like, a number of famous stories in there that Bill may have told that you're probably like, that's not exactly how I've heard this. Or it may have even been something you were there for. I mean, you know, how many different versions of the Bill Dundee, Randy Savage story have we heard over the years? You know what I mean? It's like...
Okay. Let's talk about that for a minute. I've heard several accounts of that day. He broke Bill's jaw. He did this. He did that. You know who I heard those from? People who were not there. The people that were actually in that parking lot that day all tell the same story. He ran up, he sucker punched him, he broke the bone under his eye because he never saw it coming. He did not knock him off of his feet. Dundee never went down. They continued to fight until Bill got the gun, and that was the end of it. Now, the part of the story that people do not tell that were there or who were not there, who believed the Poffo side of the story, Bill could have shot them and got away with it for self-defense because they did jump on him in a parking lot in front of many witnesses. So he held restraint in not killing Angelo and Randy, which he would have probably gotten away with if he did, because they both were on him. Randy wrote the Dundee book. I helped with timelines and different things.
Okay.
I helped Hans with his book too. But yeah, I mean, there's different stories. But usually now you hear stories from people that were not there. That's why if I tell a story, like telling the story earlier about Handsome, I will tell you where I heard it, who it came from, because I wasn't there. This is what I was told by who was there, who was a part of it. And it's just, you know, it's everybody sees everything different. And a lot of these guys hold grudges, and a lot of these guys want people to believe that I broke Bill Dundee's jaw. No, he didn't. And, you know, I was a Randy Savage fan as a kid. I was a Bill Dundee fan as a kid. I knew Lanny, and I got along with Lanny really good. I got get along with Bill Dundee wonderfully. I love Bill Dundee. That was none of my affair. I had no part in any of that. I did the DVD set with Dundee where we talk about it. And the story that Bill tells in that documentary is the story that's in the book. It's the story that he's told on other different things. His story has not turned. But you hear people that wrestled for the Poffos that will tell you that old Randy broke his jaw and put the boots to him when he was on the ground and this and that. And the people that were in the parking lot that day, and I'm not going to name any names because they probably wanted to go away themselves. but they've all said, no, he never got him off of his feet. And Angelo, you know, he was on his back and trying to get him down, and they couldn't. So, and I'll tell you, and people want to say stuff about Dundee, oh, he's a midget, oh, he's this, that, grab a hold. That was a tough man right there. And he ain't as small as you think he is.
Well, that's like one of the biggest problems with like doing wrestling history, which you know and I know and people like Al and people like Greg and others know, is it's like a weird confluence of things where it's like, one, it's a business based on a lie. So you have to take everything that you read or anyone tells you with a grain of salt. Like, two, you're dealing with people that hold grudges. So when they tell you a story, you don't 100% know if it's true or not. And three, you're dealing with people, a lot of whom have been hit in the head many thousands of times over their career. And so it's very possible their memory is not as great as it should be.
I mean, me included. That's one of the reasons that I made sure to keep all of my date books and all of my stuff from all of my years in wrestling with all my notes in them. And I've got all my – there's a tote in here in my office that has all of my legal pads in it and everything. 'Cause, I mean, I have people come up to me now and say stuff, and I have no clue – who they are. I don't know who they are. And they, you know, they remember me. Hey, we worked together and, you know, Red Jacket, West Virginia 10 years ago. Dude, do you know how many times I've wrestled since then? How many towns I have been into? You know, I'm sorry. I don't remember. And that came to me early in my career because I would talk to Handsome and to Ricky Morton and different guys and stuff that me as a fan that I remembered vividly, they had no clue of whatsoever. No memory at all, because it all runs together over time. And the longer that I was in the wrestling business, the more that I realized, okay, yeah, it's all starting to run together now. And I've been hitting the head a lot. I've had two car wrecks that should have killed me. And I, you know, so I need to make sure that everything that I do is documented and kept.
I mean, it's sort of like, I mean, I have a sort of non-used degree in history, but it's like, you know, one of like the early things that you learn is that like the importance of primary sources. It's like, you know, if you can get the real data, you know, or, you know, especially now if you have footage, then you know when something happened. You know, it's like, can you, you know, correctly date it or whatever? Do you know where it's from? And then it's like, okay, somebody writes a book that was involved in something. Okay, well, that's good, but, you know, was it vetted, you know, for how accurate it is? And then, you know, and especially now in wrestling, you're getting third and fourth and fifth things away, and you're like, okay. And even then, it's like, okay, you know, everybody, you know, uses all this, you know, newspaper. You know, Al loves going and getting his newspaper clippings, but it's like,
yeah.
Well, if they print in the newspaper what the promoter tells you, well, okay, that's a primary source, but how accurate is the information? I mean, it's like we certainly know now that, like, the news, you know, you quote-unquote can't trust the news the way you used to. But it's like, could you really ever trust the, you know, you could maybe trust the news more years ago than you can now. But it's like, it's that kind of thing that, like, we always used to tell people this. Like, it's true in wrestling. This is also true in something like comics or whatever. And you're like, I read this article about, like, the history of Superman, let's say. And it had, like, five things wrong in it. And you're like, and this went through the newspaper, presumably went through fact-checking or whatever. Say it's, like, a big piece in a magazine. What's like, if this article on Superman has this many things wrong with it, who knows how many things are wrong, like, with the front page of the newspaper for the things that were important.
That,
right?
The one thing that I, doing the research on Kingsport, that I love, and I don't know if this happened, you know, anywhere else in the country, but like the guy that covered the wrestling for the Times News, he would actually follow them to the hospital if somebody went to the hospital, and would tell you exactly how many stitches they got at Holston Valley last night, and what the shoulder injury was, and you know, I mean, he actually cared enough to follow up of what was going on, and he did so much that one of my favorite stories of this territory is, you know, I think they called him Mr. X, or maybe it was Dr. X is coming. They build him up. He comes in. He's going to do this program with Bill Caney, and Bill Caney had been the most hated heel of the Kingsport territory until he had his heart attack and he couldn't wrestle. And then it came out that he was Whitey's mentor and helped train Whitey and all that stuff. So now Bill Caney's a beloved member of this community and he made his home here. So when Bill got better after the heart attack, he worked in the office and he refereed. So they do an angle with this masked man, and the masked man jumps on Bill Caney over a finish one night, and when he grabs Bill, the police hit the ring and start clubbing this guy and arrest him for attacking Bill Caney. And they killed the whole plan of the program and everything off because they drag him to the police department. The guy covering the wrestling matches for the newspaper goes, gets the man's real name, his address, and posted in the paper the next day. They killed Dr. X off in 2 weeks. But not every other person reporting on wrestling over the years for the newspapers or whatever else was going to put that much detail into what he was doing.
And see, what's funny is you say that, and I would think if I was the promoter that this guy is actually sort of an asset to me, where he's like, mm-hmm. especially if, you know, if you have to deal with, don't you know this stuff's fake? And you're like, well, the newspaper reporter went to the hospital and he knows exactly like how this guy got hurt. He's like, you don't think he'd make that up and put it in the newspaper? Like, it's one thing for us to tell you something, but you don't think the guy's going to put this in the newspaper if it's not true, do you?
Right. Yeah. And, you know, it's just, you have to be smart to the business in every aspect, doing what Al Guest does, do what I do to what other people do, where they go through these newspaper clippings and they read this stuff and they go through everything, because the promoters are going to spin it. The newspapers are going to knock it. But that's why I always like looking in the FYIs to see who was arrested at the wrestling matches and for what. Because then you see the real heat. Okay, these people were arrested for jumping in the ring on Lord Phineas Hall. So that really happened. This guy did stab Ron Wright. And this person did throw punches at Bill Caney. So then you can look and see and tell they really had that much of heat in these towns. Ron Wright getting his plane burned up. I mean, just all this stuff that's legendary. But if you didn't grow up in a territory with this kind of violent fans, you may not believe that story. Well, here it is in the newspaper. Here's the report.
Here's the picture of the plane.
Yeah, here it is.
And I said, trust me, a wrestling promoter in 1978 is not going to spend the money to torch an airplane to take a picture of it for an angle.
Right.
Like, maybe in 1999, Vince McMahon can afford to destroy a Cadillac by pouring cement into it. But you're a billion-dollar publicly traded company. I can't see Ron Fuller spending the money to buy an airplane and let set it on fire just for an angle on TV.
Yeah, I mean, but it's great to be able to go back and find that stuff and show it and go, right, here it is. Here it is.
Definitely.
This is for real. This really happened.
Well, Bo, I want to thank you for taking the time to tell some stories, since I know you love telling stories.
Yeah, it's always great to get caught up with you. And here, I hate that it takes someone like Ole passing away for us to humanize him. You know, and I grew up super fan. These guys are larger than life to me, and they're such an important part of my life. But it's great to be able, with all this technology and all this stuff and all the research and all the personal experiences we have with these people now, to where we can truthfully say, hey, this is the guy. This is what he did. Yes, he was mean and gruff and this and that, but he helped a lot of people along the way.
And I know
what memories he gave us as wrestling fans.
And I was going to say, and speaking of honoring people while they're still alive, you guys just did, not too long ago, you did your annual Hall of Fame show, right?
Yeah. And that was this was the first year. We've been doing the Hall of Fame for 25 years. And there's a lot of legendary names in our Hall of Fame. And I want to explain how we do this Hall of Fame. We do a ballot of people that we think contributed to wrestling in East Tennessee. And of course, in years past, Ron Wright, Whitey Caldwell, Don Wright, Tony Peters, Ronnie West, all these names that people know from the territory system, Ron Fuller, Buddy Fuller, they're all in here. They're all in the Hall of Fame. But we put a list together, and if you're in the Hall of Fame, you get to vote. And if you work for us for over 10 years, you get to vote. And then we take the people with the most votes, and they go in that year. I want a legitimate Hall of Fame. This year was the first year that everybody that went in the Hall of Fame was original to us. Last year was very close to that, but we did Roy Welch last year. Ron Fuller was there to accept Roy's award. This year was Chick White, J.D. Hogg, Danny and Bam Bam Christian, Larry Bennett, who had passed away, and Misty. They all are originals to our promotion, and they all are a key to our success and the history of wrestling here the last 33 years. And I made sure to spend time with all of them before the Hall of Fame were in this side room. And I went in and told all of them congratulations and how proud I am that they got voted in. And I hope they're happy and make sure we, I'll ask them when we send out a message saying, hey, congratulations, you have been voted in by our voters. You're going in the Hall of Fame this year. Then I'll ask them, who do you want to induct you? Who do you, anything you want specially said? I mean, we make sure that it's a it's a presentation and an honor for them to get it. And we give them their flowers for what they've done in the wrestling profession here in East Tennessee. And it was a great moment, great night.
Oh, that's definitely cool.
That, you know, a lot of these guys, like Ole would never, did he do Charlotte once or twice?
I think
for the convention. I think he was at the first one and maybe a second one.
I think he's done it. I think he did at least one of them.
He just, his health got bad and he was confined to the wheelchair. I think if Ole could have did more of those or would have done more of those, I think that he may have understood the impact that he had on people's lives. Not just the wrestlers, but the fans. You know, he would have got flowers from both sides, I believe. And it's sad guys like JYD and Eddie Gilbert and several, you know, the Von Erichs. I mean, just so many other people, they would be making so much money right now at these conventions.
Well, it's funny, too. I know one of the things people have been talking about this week, because Dark Side just started again, and they did the episode on John Tenta. And it's kind of weird because, you know, he passed away young from cancer, but there's really no Dark Side to him. But he's
right.
He's a guy who's like this nice guy and had fun and made fun of himself and used to post on Wrestle Crap. You know what I mean? He's a guy that would have been great once this convention circuit got started, because he's memorable. He's got a variety of stories. He's like, you know, he was a sumo. You know, he worked in Japan. He was a big Hogan opponent. Then he was in Atlanta. You know, and he had a bunch of weird stuff, and he was one of the oddities. So he had like a wide variety of stories and seemed like a good guy. So he'd be somebody who'd be like in huge demand, like now, if he hadn't like passed away so young.
Mm-hmm. Junkyard Dog would be so over at these conventions because he just had such a personality. When you talked to Dog, you were the most important person in the world at that moment right then. He talked to you. He took time to talk to people. So he would be so over. They would probably be people in line that would get upset over the wait because he was taking time with every person that came up there. But he would have been fantastic for these things.
So how do you think Budrow would be on the convention circuit?
That's a double edged sword.
How would Good Buddy be on the convention circuit? I guess maybe
same. He would be wonderful. I just had a guy message me yesterday that had listened to me on Between the Sheets. And he said, I don't know the man. He said, hey, I just want to tell you a story. He said, I listened to you and we talked about Buddy on the last episode I was on there. And he said, when he was a teenager, he had went to the wrestling matches in Williamsburg, Kentucky, for Smoky Mountain. And he said they left the matches and they went up to get gas, and there was Buddy pumping gas. And he said he looked at Buddy, and Buddy said, hey, did you like the matches? Because he had saw him at ringside, and he said he ended up standing in the parking lot talking to Buddy for 30 minutes. And he said that was such a big moment to him in life. that this TV wrestler stood there and talked to him. And that was Buddy. That was a good Buddy. Now, if Budrow would have show up, you'd have a repeat of what happened in Charlotte the first year. But the last years of Buddy's life, he was Buddy. Actually, he was Bill. He was Bill Enzer. He was Granddad, because he was raising his grandson, and he'd lost his daughter, and he was having a rough time with the loss of Colby, but he was such a wonderful grandpa to that little boy. And he would have done these to make sure that he had money to help raise his grandson. Buddy would have been a big hit. Sherry Martel would be a huge hit at these things. I mean, it's just, I hate it for them, because that's where they would have realized what an influence they had on people's lives that I don't think they ever realized they had, including an Ole Anderson, who was hated. But guess what Ole did? Ole gave every person that was a wrestling fan in those territories an opportunity to come to the matches and throw stuff, yell at him, and take all of their weekly frustrations from their job, from their home, from their family out. He took all that upon himself, and he gave them an outlet to vent. And he did it for their entertainment. And got stabbed and cut and everything else that happened to him.
Definitely. So what kind of shows do you have coming up in the future?
We are running the last Saturday night of the month at the Armed Forces Reserve Center Armory, 399 Highway 11W, Mount Carmel, Tennessee, 1 mile west of Kingsport. That's our home base now. Was several years ago. We were gone for about 10 years, but we're back there and have a wonderful agreement with the federal government to run the building. Have a wonderful advertising partner in Dalton Direct Carpets and Flooring. And we produce weekly streaming television. You can watch on the Southern States Wrestling YouTube every weekend. On Saturdays, we drop a recent program called Legacy, and on Sundays we drop Retro, which is a 30-minute look at the history every week, where we go back and show big matches and events and different things from our archives. So if you have not already, please hit Southern States Wrestling on YouTube, subscribe, and hit the notification bell. We got the big Appalachian Fairgrounds thing coming up the second Saturday of July. That's the block party. It's our summer bash. There's 4,000 to 5,000 people there every year. It's a huge event. We'll have wrestling there again this year. We will be at the Coffee County Fair in Middle Tennessee on September the 4th. Always a great time down there. I got events coming up in West Virginia for American Pro Wrestling, Mega Pro Wrestling. I'll be back over for Appalachian Mountain Wrestling in Kentucky soon. In December, I got the full clean bill of health from my cardiologist. My heart is 100%. So I'm trying to make as much pounds and as many towns as I can and make as many bookings as I can, because I don't know how many more years I got in wrestling. So if anybody out there would be interested in booking me, you can reach out on Facebook, Pro Wrestler Bo James, Twitter, King of Kingsport, Instagram, King of Kingsport, or you can email me at kingofkingsport@gmail.com.
And it's almost baseball season.
Yes. Yeah, I had to do a little switching around because some stuff I've got coming up in the spring. I was unable to coach, but I'm going to coach fall ball this year. So we're going to get to do that. And I hate it. I've been over to the ballpark a couple of times. I'm still in all the message in and all that stuff and see what's going on. I'm still helping sell the Dr. Enoughs and all that great stuff to help pay for to keep the league going. Because, I mean, our league is getting bigger and bigger every year. We got 700 and some kids last year. We have it from T-ball all the way to teenagers, girls and boys, softball. We've sent a softball team to the World Series twice in the last decade. We have at least a couple of teams in the state tournament every year for different divisions. The last 2 years, we have sent five different divisions to the state tournament from winning the divisions up here. So, I mean, we're a competitive league. Daniel Boone Little League, Great Tennessee. Look them up on Facebook, and if you can, send them a few bucks to help keep this thing running, because we've got so many kids, and it is very expensive to run a little league.
Definitely. So, yeah, check out what Bo is doing. Like you said, Bo was just on Between the Sheets a couple weeks ago. I made sure to put this over on social media that you did a great story about money marks in wrestling and why people get in the business and how things really haven't changed all that much since so you guys were talking about the early 90s and it's 2024 and, you know, the money marks may have more money, but they're still money marks.
And the wrestling schools opened up and made it easy for anybody to get into business. You know, it ain't yesterday no more. But we got a bright future, and there's a lot of great talent out here. And that's the thing we're doing now with my promotion. We're taking this young talent, help mold them, put them on camera, put them in front of an audience, have them doing interviews, have them doing stuff. That way, if they ever get a shot at the bigger stage, then they're ready for it. They know to work to the hard camera. They know where the roaming camera's at. They know to hit a time cue. They know how to do a 30-second, 1 minute, or 2 minute interview. You know, it's just getting them ready. And you can follow us, Southern States Wrestling, on Facebook, YouTube. Southern States Wrestling, Instagram, and X is SSW Wrestling 1. I forgot to plug those.
Somebody asked me recently when, you know, all the news happened recently. Like, they're like, well, is this going to be the end of the business? And I'm like a cockroach, this business will never die. Like, it may not be a billion-dollar TV company, but I'm like, there will always be little tiny promotions running county fairs and whatever. It's like, it's such an American institution, you know, that's now, you know, like 150 years old or whatever. It's like, it won't go away. It may not be what you think it is, but it will probably always still exist. And I mean, you know that when you're on the, like, the grassroots level, so you know, you know, even if something super horrible happens, you know, to one of the big TV companies, you know, you'll still be having your show and your town and your county fairs over the summer.
They have tried to write the business off for 100 years, and it continues to rise from the ashes like a phoenix.
Definitely. So, thanks again, Bo. We will talk
Thank
to
you, Mark.
Thanks, Bo. Yeah, check out all of Bo's stuff. And we will talk to everybody next time.